This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this show on Free Speech TV nationwide and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates. Just days before the UK elections, US President Donald Trump has wielded his Twitter account as a weapon once more, this time accusing London's Mayor Sadiq Khan of making a, quote, pathetic excuse for the attack that killed seven people on London Bridge last Saturday. Mr. Khan has in turn questioned whether Trump should be received in London for a visit. The bridge attack came just days after a suicide bombing in Manchester at a concert where nearly two dozen people, including children, were killed and over 100 injured. Labour Party leader Jeremy Corbyn, who is incumbent Prime Minister Theresa May's main rival, is now surging in the polls despite the deadly attacks. Amidst the rhetoric about terrorism and its funders, the issue at the heart of the election is how Britain exits from the EU after last year's shocking Brexit vote. Joining me now is Juan Cole. He is the Richard P. Mitchell Collegiate Professor of History at the University of Michigan. He's written several books, including The New Arabs, How the Wired and Global Youth of the Middle East is Transforming It, and Engaging the Muslim World. He has a column at truthdig.com, and his blog, Informed Comment, can be found at juancole.com. Welcome to the program, Juan.
Thank you, Sonali.
So first, let's talk about this disagreement, if you will, between Trump and London's mayor. Trump seems to be quite happy to use what Londoners are experiencing to justify his own agenda at home. And I'm wondering if you think his attacks on Sadiq Khan has anything to do with the fact that Sadiq Khan is who he is, a Muslim, the first Muslim mayor of London, etc.
Oh, I think it has everything to do with it. I mean, the first thing to say is that it's so shameful that President Trump, in his first reactions to this horrible attack at Manchester, and then the follow-on in London, has, to my knowledge, not yet expressed any empathy for the British people who are suffering at the hands of terrorists. His whole approach has been to shore up his demand for a visa ban on people from certain countries of certain ethnicities. And then he seems almost willfully to have misunderstood what Sadiq Khan has said with regard to extra police on the streets, but that the public shouldn't be alarmed by their presence, should be instead reassured by them. Trump tried to turn that into somehow Sadiq Khan playing down the seriousness of the attack.
Let's go through some of the tweets that Trump came out with in quick succession. Initially, he simply said, whatever the United States can do to help out in London and the UK, we will be there. We are with you. God bless. And then immediately, we must stop being politically correct and get down to the business of security for our people. If we don't get smart, it will only get worse. He went on to then say, criticize, basically point out that London's mayor says there's no reason to be alarmed. And then, interestingly enough, said, do you notice we're not having a gun debate right now? Trump tweeted, that's because they used knives and a truck. And then, of course, Juan, right away, a couple of days later, you had just on Tuesday, a mass shooting in Florida, where a disgruntled former employee of a company went and killed five people, just two less than the number that were killed on London Bridge. A gun was used there. Trump, of course, made zero comment about that. But that's not seen as terrorism. How does Trump use what's happening in London to justify his Muslim ban? He likes to call it a travel ban. I mean, what's the really, you know, aren't those apples and oranges?
Well, obviously, Trump has a white nationalist ideology, and he sees the world through that ideology, so that it is white people versus brown people and black people and Asians and on and on. So his reaction to these attacks in London was that of a white nationalist. He attacked the mayor of London, who is of Muslim heritage, as you said. People had to put enormous pressure on him to say anything at all about the horrific white nationalist attack on two white guys in Oregon who were killed standing up to him when he was harassing a Muslim woman in who was veiled. So Trump has a blind spot, and it comes out of his racism. And it's extremely distressing that this should be the ordinary, everyday discourse of the American White House. It's something as though we had gone back to the 19th century.
Now, of course, what plays to the advantage of progressives is that Trump tends to be his own worst enemy. So he went on to, you know, just spew all of the stuff about his travel ban, saying that that we need a travel ban. He's doubling down. He's saying the Justice Department should have stayed with the original travel ban, not the watered down, politically correct version they submitted to the Supreme Court, and on and on. And every time he speaks about what the travel ban is really, which is a Muslim ban, he actually sabotages his own efforts to institute this ban, right?
Yes, because the Department of Justice lawyers looked at his initial executive order, which was apparently written by white nationalists and the White House, like Steve Bannon. And found that it was unconstitutional, could never have gotten through. And so they tried a second time by taking out some of the clearly unconstitutional language in the initial visa ban. An exception was made for Christians to become refugees from Syria, whereas Muslims would be excluded. That's clearly a First Amendment violation. And so they tried to clean it up. Jim Mattis, the Secretary of Defense, put pressure to have the Iraqis exempted, even though still a portion of Iraq is under the control of ISIL or Daesh. And that was one of the criteria for including the original seven countries. So the thing became a mishmash and was also immediately struck down By the courts, even by the relatively conservative Fourth District. Now we'll go to the Supreme Court. But one of the things that the Department of Justice attempted to do was to maintain that this was not a ban, that it was merely a security measure having to do with visa issuance. So for Trump to come back out and say, no, it's a ban, we should call it a ban, the original one was better, that was my intent, and a lot of the court proceedings have been about what Trump's intent was. So he has probably prejudiced the current appeal to the Supreme Court of the second visa ban on people from six predominantly Muslim countries. By his boorishness.
He did also sort of say, well, if we can't get the Muslim ban, we'll essentially use our own discretion, because he said, in any event, we are extreme vetting, in all caps, people coming into the U.S. in order to help keep our country safe. The courts are slow and political. Now, Juan, many of the attacks, possibly most of them, that Europe has been subject to, haven't they been by people who are born and raised there, or at least spent a majority of their lives there, that you know, Europe's immigration policies wouldn't necessarily address if you wanted to even apply what's happening in Europe to the United States?
Yeah, well, the first thing to say is that Europol does an annual report on terrorism in Europe.
This is the European police, the sort of EU-wide police, yeah.
For the European Union.
Yeah.
It's a step down from Interpol.
Yeah.
And they do an annual report on terrorism in Europe. Now, with some unfortunate exceptions, as with 2015, they report that the biggest single source of terrorist attacks and planned attacks in Europe is the European far right.
Which is, of course, quite similar to here in the U.S., right?
Exactly. Well, the same thing is true here. And then the second is separatist movements in Europe.
Right.
And then the third source is the far left, and Muslims come in, Muslim Europeans come in fourth.
Wow.
And then security, yeah. And then security specialists have found that there's this odd phenomenon that is not entirely clear why it's the case, but that almost no terrorism is committed in Europe by Muslims, by Europeans of Muslim heritage, who are either first-generation immigrants or third-generation, or later.
So it's the second-generation Muslim.
It's the second-generation. It seems almost to be a problem of being between worlds and alienation and so forth. Whatever is going on, it has very little to do, obviously, with Islam per se. And of course, these terrorists in Britain in the last two attacks, one was an ISIL cell from Libya, where ISIL had gained a foothold in the Sirte, and has been defeated there by the Libyans. And then the second one was the Al-Muhajirun, a radical extremist group, which is now linking up with ISIL. So there is a problem, obviously, of radical extremist young Muslims, but they're a vanishingly tiny proportion of the European Muslim community, and they don't get up typically to as much mischief as the far right does in Europe.
I want to talk about the UK elections in just a moment and how these attacks might impact that. But and the other conversation around terrorism that's been happening has been on an international level with the announcement on Monday, the sort of bizarre, unexpected announcement that Saudi Arabia and its allies, together with the US, it seems, has suddenly identified Qatar as the main funder of international terrorism and has cut off all diplomatic ties. And Trump echoed that, saying that, you know, this was the right way to go about it, and sort of hailed his meeting. He said, it's so good to see the Saudi Arabia visit with a king and 50 countries already paying off. They said they would take a hard line on funding extremism. An old reference was pointing to Qatar. Perhaps this will be the beginning of the end to the horror of terrorism. He's almost suggesting that it was his idea or his meeting with the Arab leaders when he visited Saudi Arabia that prompted this. What's going on here? I mean, why Qatar?
You know, this is a struggle in Middle Eastern politics between two forms of a political Islam. Trump apparently is easily manipulated and believes whatever he was told by the last person he talked to. And I don't want to impose on the patience of your listeners to get into the niceties of Muslim fundamentalist theology, but basically, on the one hand, you have the Muslim Brotherhood, which is a reform of Sunni Islam and an attempt to inject a kind of a fundamentalist vision of Sunni Islam into politics. So it's the religious right of some Sunni countries like Egypt and so forth. And then on the other side, you have the Saudi kind of Islam, which is called Wahhabism, which, you know, if the Muslim Brotherhood is kind of Opus Dei, or if it's kind of far-right Catholicism, Wahhabism is you know, the radical Protestants of the 1500s, no saints, no intercession, and so forth, and allegiance to the prince. So the Wahhabis and the Muslim Brotherhood don't get along, and they've fallen out more and more in the past few years. Qatar is supporting the Muslim Brotherhood. The Saudis are supporting Wahhabis, and in Sunni countries, the Wahhabis typically are called Salafis. They're slightly different, but it's the same group. And if you look at Syria, for instance, the Saudis supported a group called the Army of Islam, Jaish al-Islam, which was hardline Salafi. Whereas Qatar is supporting Muslim Brotherhood groups.
So it sounds like Trump has been dragged into an internal fight. And if you actually look at the ideology, or many have said, if you look at the ideology of those people who do foment these bloody attacks, they're more inspired by Wahhabism, the Saudi ideology, rather than what Qatar is supporting.
Yeah, to be fair, you know, I'm not sure there's a strong ideological link to terrorism on either side. That is to say, you have had people turn to terrorism who were brought up Muslim Brotherhood. Mohammed Atta, the lead hijacker on 9/11, was from a Muslim Brotherhood family in Egypt. You have had people, like Osama bin Laden himself, who were brought up Wahhabis. Turn to terrorism. I think terrorism is a tool of political struggle. And so one can be, you know, enticed into it by one's political goals, regardless of the exact theological background that one might have. And it should be remembered also that some of the people who've been involved in what we think of over here as Muslim terrorism were secular-minded people. One of the hijackers in 9/11 was a Sunni Lebanese secularist. So it can, you know, terrorism can also sweep up people who have grievances of a kind of a vague nationalist sort that we Muslims are suffering, you know.
So what does this finger pointing at Qatar mean then? Is this going to now all of a sudden refocus the U.S. policy on terrorism? I mean, Trump basically said, during my recent trip to the Middle East, I stated there can no longer be funding of radical ideology. Leaders pointed to Qatar. Look. Does this mean that now Qatar is going to be sanctioned? Seems like it's going to have just as little impact on actual terrorism as what the U.S. had been doing before, which is nothing.
Well, to the extent that the U.S. is encouraging the Saudis to do whatever they like, then the Wahhabi kind of extremism will benefit from American support, as it often has since the Cold War. The other thing that's not being sort of stated so clearly here is that part of the struggle is over Iran. And whether to try to make Iran a pariah and completely exclude it from the Middle East, or to see it as a power that's there, that's a regional power that has to be talked to and negotiated with. And, you know, 10 years ago, it was King Abdullah of Saudi Arabia who was inviting the Iranians to Riyadh for talks. Now the new King Salman and the younger men around him want to do Iran in. So they're pursuing this Yemen war on the grounds that it's Yemen had come under Iranian influence. It's not true, but that's their claim. Now they're trying to isolate Qatar simply because the Qatari government feels that one should, you know, continue to talk to the Iranians.
Seeing Iran as the enemy is consistent both with the Saudi line and Israel's approach to the Middle East, which the U.S. is only happy to do. Interestingly enough, if you're talking about democracy, which there were some interesting moments when a State Department official under Trump was like a deer caught in the headlights when asked about Saudi democracy. Iran is more democratic than Saudi and actually has a rich history of democracy, some of which was squashed by the U.S. itself, right?
Yes, well, let's face it, the Trump administration has made it very clear, and Rex Tillerson, the Secretary of State, said this openly, that human rights would not be a factor in policymaking. I should also say that, you know, Saudi Arabia is a horrible absolute monarchy. It has no civil rights to speak of. The king's word is law. And it has had a few municipal elections, but at the national level, everything comes from the court. It's also the case that although Iran has elections, it has an elected parliament, it has an elected president, it vets the candidates carefully. And so it's not exactly democracy. It's democracy within the limits that the clerical elite will set.
Let's turn to the UK's elections and democracy in the Western world. So the snap elections called by Theresa May earlier this year was an attempt to get a bigger majority in Parliament to arrange or to basically determine how Britain exits from the European Union. And the Labour Party and the Conservative Party have slightly different approaches to how Brexit should be conducted. Then come these attacks, the one in Manchester and the London Bridge attack. And Theresa May, on the one hand, could be said to be partially responsible for any lapses in security since she was the Home Office Secretary. Or you could sort of see that incumbents are usually strengthened when there are terrorist attacks. And a couple of weeks ago, when we had covered the lead up to the UK elections, it looked like Theresa May might sort of edge ahead. Then you see this surge in the polls of the Labour Party, in particular Jeremy Corbyn's leadership. And now there's talk of a possible Prime Minister Jeremy Corbyn, who has been seen as the Bernie Sanders of the UK. How do you explain this? And what are the issues that are resonating with people? Is it Corbyn's position on the terrorist attacks? Is it his position on how exiting from the EU might happen? Or is it his economic justice platform, or all three?
Well, I think it must be partly that Theresa May is not very good as a politician. There was this incident recently where a nurse complained to her who works in the national health system, which in Britain is quite good, but as the Tories want to fund it less, hadn't had a raise for 8 years. And May said, well, dearie, there is no money tree. You know, the Tories are about cutting
back. There is
back.
No money tree.
Yeah, that's what she told this nurse who gets up every morning and goes and helps sick people. And she's been cutting taxes on the wealthy in Britain and wants to cut taxes more on the wealthy. And obviously, the only thing you can do if you continually cut taxes on the wealthy is to start skimping on social services. So Corbyn is making the point that she cut 20,000 police. People are saying London would be more secure if its police force hadn't been devastated by these redundancies that May and her party are behind. I think the British public is probably center-right on the whole, and Corbyn is on the left, and he probably ordinarily wouldn't have much chance, but I think that May, the way that she handles herself in public is telegraphs too much about what she's really about for the stomach of the British middle classes. So I think, you cannot tell about these elections on the basis of these spot polls. But it certainly seems to be the case that her decision to go to a snap election, which seemed politically wise at the time, has turned out to be a real gamble that she hadn't counted on.
Paul Mason, in an interview recently, said that when Jeremy Corbyn essentially said, we're going to tax the rich in order to pay for college education, you had a million young people, basically sign up to vote or to support the Labour Party. How much of what we're seeing is also simply people just being tired of being pushed? I mean, you can only push people so far before the failings of neoliberal capitalism start to become so apparent that the rich become targets.
Well, I think that's absolutely true, that the kind of neoliberal program of the Conservative Party in Britain of cutting public services, trying to privatize public goods, has been going on for some time, but it may, it may have reached a tipping point where it really is hurting people, and people are beginning to rethink the promises, of course, that the Conservatives make, are that there will be more efficiency and lower prices and economic prosperity. And wherever neoliberalism has been tried in a thoroughgoing way, it has produced quite the opposite. Usually it leads to this enormous concentration of wealth in a few hands, opportunities for insider trading of various sorts and corruption, and the deprival of middle-class people of opportunities for higher education, certain kinds of services get cut, and so forth. So I think when this kind of radical neoliberalism begins as a project, the proponents of it can put a happy face on it and make it seem as though it's promising. But as it proceeds, the downside becomes more and more apparent.
Care to make a prediction as you and I are talking around the eve of the UK elections, what you think might happen?
I know a very great deal about the past, but I have no idea what's going to happen.
And right, our own election in November and the Brexit vote suddenly make it quite a frightening exercise to make any sort of predictions these days. We live in a slightly more unpredictable world today. Well, Juan, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. We'll post a link to your website, juancole.com, from our site later today.
Thank you so much, Sonal.
My guest is Juan Cole. He is the Richard P. Mitchell Collegiate Professor of History at University of Michigan. And he blogs, his blog is called Informed Comment. You can find it at juancole.com. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. You can also find us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, and Vimeo.